This is Jason Ross with the Ashbrook Center. I'm with Todd Estes, Associate Professor of History at Oakland University. We're going to ask him some questions about his work and his career as a historian. The first question is, what was it that drew you to study early American history?
Probably the most important thing for me was a class I took as an undergraduate at the University of Tennessee. I had a class on Jeffersonian America my junior year with a professor named Bruce Wheeler, who had studied with Merrill Peterson at the University of Virginia. And this was a class, it was the first one I'd ever taken in early American history, and it was a class that was fascinating to me because I'd always been interested in Thomas Jefferson, but didn't particularly know much about the period or the time or anything like that, and really wanted to learn more about this. And the semester was incredibly transformative because we not only learned a lot about Thomas Jefferson in that period, but that was what drew me to the whole field of early American history. And I sort of knew from that point forward that I wanted to be my professor, basically. I wanted to do what he did and teach early American history at the college level. So that occurred when I was 20 years old as a college junior, and the rest of my life since then has been pursuing what he did.
Very good. And then you went off to graduate school at the University of Kentucky, where you studied with a very influential American historian, Lance Banning. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what contributions Lance Banning made to our understanding of early American history?
Yeah, I think several. I was drawn to Kentucky because of Lance Banning's reputation. That's why I went there in the first place. And I think Lance made several critical contributions to early American history and historiography. The first is with his first book, The Jeffersonian Persuasion, which looked at the ideology behind the Jeffersonians and how they emerged. He found a way to link that back to the same concerns of the American Revolution, and particularly in arguing that the Jeffersonians were really influenced by some of the same kinds of ideas and fears that the American revolutionaries had been. So what he did historiographically was to take the ideas of Bernard Bailyn and Gordon Wood, who had argued that English oppositionist thought and a fear of tyranny and conspiracy and attacks on liberty had really motivated the American revolutionaries. He argued that the same thing also explains the Jeffersonians in the 1790s and beyond in their reaction to the Hamiltonian Federalists, and that their language, their rhetoric, their ideology is really deeply rooted in that opposition thought that grew out of the Revolution and was extended in the 1790s. And that was really a significant breakthrough because the last chapters of Gordon Wood's Creation of the American Republic argue for an end to classical politics, an end to classical republicanism. And what Banning did was to sort of say they don't end that quickly. They certainly explain how the Jeffersonians understood the 1790s and saw the Hamiltonian program as kind of an extension of the British consolidated Walpolean ministerial models that featured, you know, corruption and tyranny and the kinds of things that led the American revolutionaries to rebel. The second great contribution I think Lance made in his second book, Sacred Fire of Liberty, on James Madison, was really to I think challenge the reigning orthodoxy about seeing James Madison as somebody who had made a radical change from being a nationalist in the 1780s to being a states rightist in the 1790s. And I think Banning suggested that he did not make that big a break, that in fact his nationalism was never quite as strong and of a different stripe than Hamilton's, and that his states rights position was not quite a states rights position, but a much more nuanced, subtle interpretation that makes Madison a much more consistent thinker than he's often seen. And I think what Banning also did in that book was to demonstrate that for Madison, the key question, the consistent question, was always, what is the greatest threat to liberty? And in the 1780s, to Madison, the greatest threat to liberty came at the state level, from the legislatures and unstable legislation, turnover in office, mutability of legislation, inconsistency of laws, etc. In the 1790s, the greatest threat to liberty for Madison came from the national government and from Hamilton and the consolidation of power in the executive branch. So seen in that way, as Banning portrayed it, Madison is in fact entirely consistent in that his primary motivation is always to protect liberty from whatever the greatest threat to liberty is at the time, and that's consistent from the 1780s to the 1790s and beyond. And I think what Banning did there was to significantly revise that understanding of seeing Madison as a flip-flopper or someone who changed his mind, went from one position to another. And I think he suggested a way in which you could interpret Madison as being, in fact, quite consistent if you understand what Madison's sense was of what was most important to protect.
Your own work is in the early Republican era. You've written a book called The Jay Treaty Debate, Public Opinion, and the Evolution of Early American Political Culture. My first question on this is, what is it that history teachers ought to know about the Jay Treaty?
Well, it's in some ways, I think what the treaty is about is the least important thing about it. The book is about the Jay Treaty debate, and so what I try to do there is look at the not so much the treaty itself, which was a commercial treaty with Great Britain. I think there were 28 points to the treaty. It involved a number of commercial things, size of vessels, range of trading and things like that, most favored nation status. I mean, it wasn't called that, but essentially that for both countries. But the most important thing about the book, I think, and about the Jay Treaty debate is the debate itself over the treaty, which exposed a number of crucial issues. Everything from, for example, from presidential prerogative over executive power functions. When the House of Representatives called for Washington's papers on the treaty, he refused to send them, saying that would be a violation, that this was a presidential prerogative, that he was not required to turn those over. And he really stood up to the House in that matter and essentially made a very important stand on an issue that has had reverberations down to the present day in American history about the relative powers of the presidency versus Congress on foreign policy matters. I think even more significantly, the debate over the Jay Treaty really helped to implement the concept of public opinion as a major factor in American politics, because both pro and anti-treaty sides took to the newspapers, organized petition drives, took to the streets, organized rallies, and really tried to mobilize and influence something called public opinion, recognizing that this was a real power in the political system. And I think that recognition really changed the way politics was practiced. It made it much more open, much more democratic in a small D way, in the sense that this was now something that was necessary to take to the people, however the people were defined, through the newspapers, through public rallies, through things like this. And so I think it sort of made public opinion readily agreed upon as a major factor in politics, and it remained that way from that time on. So I'm not sure the Jay Treaty created that, because I think in a lot of ways the debate over the treaty has a lot of important precedents in the debate over the ratification of the Constitution, where again both sides took to the newspapers, took to the streets, organized rallies, etc. But I think the Jay Treaty really made that more permanent and legitimate. And I think from that point on, the need to mobilize public opinion, to have it on your side, became critical in every political battle that we've had since then. So I think if teachers are looking for an opportunity to study the origins of where does the power of public opinion come from, if they're looking for an opportunity to study the questions over the legitimacy, the presence of public opinion, I think the debate over the Jay Treaty is a great place to look for that. And what my book tries to do is to study the arguments, study the mobilization, study the petition drives, and study the way in which both pro and anti-treaty forces try to reach out to and tap into and persuade and convert public opinion.
Were both Federalists and Republicans using the same public opinion outlets, or we might call them technologies, in the same ways? Were Federalists more successful than Republicans, or Republicans more successful than Federalists?
They were both using the same methods, the same methodology, same approaches, which was primarily newspapers for these battles. And one of the things the book argues is that the Federalists were actually much, much better at this than they have usually been portrayed. The Federalists were seen, and they were elitist, certainly, and they've often been seen as anti-democratic. And I think that's certainly true at an ideological level. But what my book argues is that at an operational level, the Federalists were very, very good at mobilizing to convert public opinion. They went to the rallies, they spoke at public rallies, they took to the newspapers, they drafted what we would consider opinion editorials, basically, and took these to the public and made the case for the treaty, made the case for the supremacy of the executive branch over the legislative branch and foreign policy, They took, made these arguments deliberately and consciously, and I think they did this very, very successfully. So whatever their reservations about this new kind of politics, whatever reservations they had about the democratization of politics and about the need to cultivate public opinion, they were able to overcome those in the Jay Treaty debate and do that very, very effectively. And I argued they did that previously in the Democratic Societies and the Whiskey Rebellion, in which they contrasted George Washington to the Whiskey Rebels. And they also did that in the episode with Citizen Janae and Neutrality, in which they, again, once again, posited George Washington against Edmund Janae and essentially asked the American public, who do you trust and who do you support? And in the Jay Treaty debate, they did much the same thing as well. So I think the Federalists were much, much more adept at cultivating public opinion than they have often been portrayed in the historiography. And I think that was one of the main contributions I tried to make in the book, was to suggest that they were much, much better at this, even though they were troubled by it, even though they were ambivalent about it, and even though ultimately this they were opening the door to something that they were going to be beaten at by the Jeffersonians, who were far more comfortable with appeals to the public, with popular politics, and with democratization. But in the context of the 1790s, the Federalists were able to consistently win those contests, I think, because they really did a very good job of playing the game of popular politics, even if they didn't fully believe in it, or even if they were deeply ambivalent about popular politics.
Interesting. Finally, you're working on a book right now about the debate on ratification that occurred in the public press. Tell me how this book will fit within your interest in the development of public opinion in the early American Republic.
It actually grew directly out of the Jay Treaty project, because when I finished that, I was sort of struck by earlier examples of that. Prior to Citizen Janae, which was 1793, and the Whiskey Rebellion, which was 1794. And I was sort of immediately drawn to the debate over ratification because it was once again a debate. And just as the Jay Treaty debate lasted almost a year, from the summer of 1795 to late spring of 1796, the ratification debate obviously lasted a year, maybe even longer if you count the ultimate ratification of Rhode Island and North Carolina as well. It goes on for much longer. But again, about a year-long battle for public opinion. So I was sort of drawn to the ratification debate by the same kinds of questions that I was asking about the Jay Treaty debate, and wanting to know again about the role of newspapers, the role of public opinion, the role of persuasion, and to really look at the ways in which both sides, those favoring and opposing the Constitution, took their case to the public. How did they make their arguments? What lines of argument did they pursue? How did they frame their arguments they made for the public? And I think what I was really drawn to here was the success or lack of success of both Federalist and Anti-Federalist in the ability to frame their case and make their case to the American public. Because I think there are a lot of different reasons why the Constitution was ratified, but a lot of it does ultimately turn, I think, on the ability of each side or inability of each side to make its case to the public. And I think in the ratification debate, we realize once again that there is the recognition by political leaders of this entity called public opinion, that it is there, that it is a real thing, that it needs to be cultivated, and that having public opinion on your side or being able to plausibly claim that public opinion is on your side is critical. And I think this is almost a new era in American politics. And I think as I was concluding the Jay Treaty book, I was sort of thinking about, was this, I didn't think the Jay Treaty debate started this, and I'm not even sure that the ratification debate starts this, because you can probably find examples back in the colonial period of attempts to mobilize public opinion. But I think certainly on the national level, for a year-long debate on a critical public policy question, I think the ratification debate could benefit from a study that tries to look at the efforts at mobilization and persuasion and recognition of public opinion, and the ways in which both Federalists and Anti-Federalists approach the problem of trying to, how do we persuade the public? How do we win them over to our side? Which arguments will work? What kind of rhetoric will work? What kind of tone and style will work? And how do we link that rhetoric and style to the actual substance of the Constitution?
Well, very good. We'll look forward to seeing that book shortly.
I hope so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jason.